Welcome to the Music Ed Matters podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Emily Williams-Birch, and this podcast, it exists for you. Whether you're a music lover, an educator, a choir member, each week we bring guests to the show to help explore what matters in music. I'm so glad that you're here. Welcome to the show. Hello, and welcome to episode 34, The Doctor is in. This is my first attempt at a YouTube while also recording a podcast with myself. There is no guest. There are just listener questions. And y'all, this is number 3 in the series of questions that I asked my introduction to music students at the college level. Yes, don't worry. I gave them bonus. It was not mandatory, but they have seriously asked some of the best questions. You can jump back and catch series number 1 and number 2 from episode 30 and 26, but this is episode 34, and I have a list of really great questions today. We will start by looking at where the singing voice came from. Then we'll kind of go a little bit to the side and look at the history of the oboe. You're not going to want to miss that question because it is so perfectly worded. Then we'll jump into a really cool story about Mozart's Requiem because one of the students asked, and that's pretty cool. Then we'll talk about pop culture. What is genre? Why does it happen? Why do songs get classified into genres? And then specific questions about the country genre and gospel genre. Hopefully, if you're watching this on YouTube, you like the fun of the backgrounds, but I'm really excited that you're here. As always, the Music Ed Matters podcast is made possible by the awesome people over at Kennison Choral Company. Check them out. Use the code MUSICMATTERS at checkout to save 20%. For now, the doctor is in, and it's time to answer some listening questions. This is episode 34, Questions from Introduction to Music Class, Series 3.
Something I would really like to know is how people found their voice. Not like people today, but the first people that sang. How did they know to sing? How did they find that voice? Like, how did it come about? How did people know that they could just sing, and if they would sing something specific, there would be a different tune with a different texture, with a different harmony? Just how did they know to sing? I think it'll be really neat to learn and neat to discover and see all the different explanations behind that. And I don't know, I'm just really excited to learn about it. I haven't wondered for a long time, but I started thinking about it the other day, and I've been wondering it, and then I started really thinking about it, and I thought it would be something really interesting and discover all about it. So I'm really excited to hear the answers.
How did people find their voices? This question could go a lot of different ways. For example, how are you finding your voice right now during COVID times? How are you finding a place for your voice to be heard? But let's go back to actually the beginning of singing. You know, there are writings that exist talking about vocal pedagogy as far back as the Renaissance period. Renaissance being about 1450 to 1600. Matthew Hawk wrote an article about this in October of 2018. It's titled The Historical Landmarks of Singing and Vocal Pedagogy. In this document, he goes through all of the major writings about vocal pedagogy. So that kind of explains the study of teaching voice and the singing voice. But if you look on Lawrence University's website, they have a fantastic document that goes before that treatise in the Renaissance. This is called The Development of Voice from Antiquity to 1590. So antiquity meaning ancient past, aka before the Middle Ages. So this document talks about where did singing come from. And although we're not sure the exact origin of speech or singing, the evidence is there starting in Mesopotamian cultures from 3500 BC. But the BBC, we're going to go back to that Lawrence article in a second. The BBC claims that music came before language, saying that research suggests that music may date back to monkeys, maybe 50 to 40,000 years ago, to the Neanderthals. So that's an interesting little tidbit. Anyway, back to the Lawrence article. This article does talk about the importance of music in art in the Mesopotamian cultures from about 3500 to 500 BC. And it talks about how music was considered an art, and you could tell by looking at the different research in these Mesopotamian cultures. Things that we do know that aren't controversial or related to any type of science or anything like that would be the influence and the impact of the Roman Catholic Church. Now, the Roman Catholic Church actually controlled the development of Western music starting in about the 4th century AD, and that continued for 13 centuries. So if you're watching this recording on YouTube, you'll notice that there is a cathedral in the background of my backdrop, and that's because polyphony originated at this cathedral with the likes of Leonin and Periton. So although the beginning of where music came from, where people found their voice came from, could be dated back to the Neanderthals or Mesopotamia, the fact that singing that we know today in Western cultures dates back to the church. And the first harmony, to answer that question, the first harmonies and textures were actually invented because music was considered to be a divine line to God. And so there were certain harmonies that were tied to the divine. And that's why the early harmonies were fourths and fifths, and there were other harmonies that you didn't touch. And then as music progressed, there was eventually a common practice that was eventually written down in a lot of different treatises, especially by Rousseau. Yes, that's right. I'm sorry, I got distracted. My dog wanted to be in on the action. Anyway, that happened about the 1700s. And so there's a lot of different things that you can look at in relation to why singing was being used. So maybe we look at it in that way. From the very beginning, it was a means of communication, and then it became a means of art, and then it became a big part of the Christian system. And so there is a ton of great information out there. I would highly recommend this book I found called A History of Singing. It was published in 2012 by Potter and Sorrell by Cambridge Press, and that was a fascinating read to answer the questions. But the bullet points of this one: how do people find their voice? They needed to communicate. They needed to be a part of the worship service, and they wanted music to be a big part of that. They needed art. We all need art. And that's why we have the Music Matters podcast. Anyway, that is question number one. Let's go on to the next one.
I was listening to one of Bach's cantatas, 140, I want to say, and I couldn't help but notice the oboe. Personally, I never really liked the oboe. It's high, reedy sound. It never really appealed to me. I never really liked it, even with its odd appearance. And I heard double reeds are not really that easy to play. My question is how it came into music, how it was brought into things like orchestras and concerts and just bands in general. You know, when I think of an oboe, I kind of think of a guy with a turban and a cobra coming out of a pot, I guess. That's kind of stereotypical. But that's my question.
I love the oboe. I actually played the oboe in middle school and high school. Let's talk about the history of it, because I think if we answer some of the history of the oboe and where it came from, A, it's really fun. The ancestors of the oboe have some awesome names. And B, it answers the question of how the oboe found its place in the orchestra. So let's go back to ancient history. Double reed instruments date back to images from Mesopotamia around 3000 BC. The Greeks and the Romans actually highly regarded the double reed instruments, aka if you played a double reed instrument, you were seriously rock stars. You had high social standing, you had great popularity, you had many privileges, and it was not called the oboe in Greek and Roman times. It was called the olos and the tibia. Those are the ancient forerunners of the oboe. As we move forward, if you're watching this on YouTube, you'll see I have some singing minstrels in the backdrop of my picture. But the next thing that happened was the minstrels played an instrument called the shawm. Now, it's not known exactly if this is a descendant from the Greek or Roman version of the double reed instruments, because there were a lot of things like migration and stuff that was happening. But it's thought that this is the next in the line that led to the oboe. It's the shawm. And it was played by minstrels who played all different types of instruments. But the cool part about these double reeds is that your lips were not actually touching the double reeds. It wasn't until the 17th century when the shawm became the hautboy. This is spelled hautboy, like hautboy, like I want a hautboy, I want you know, 2000s hip hop called? Anyway, the Oh Boy was when the reed and the lips finally connected. So the reeds make direct contact with your lips. And this became part of innovations coming out of France. We all know like croissants because they come out of France. All the things that come out of France, musical things especially, become popular. So the oboe, renovated and rejuvenated out of France, becomes wildly popular, starting in France and going all over Europe. And it was called the oboe. It eventually ended up in the orchestra. And initially, these double-reeded oboe things were just there to double the violins. But by the classical period, they began to assert themselves, and they were given their first solo obbligatos, meaning a single instrument playing along with a solo, in opera arias. And then they were also all the rage in chamber ensembles, thinking duets and all sorts of things like that. By the 18th century, there were more technological advances, and the name the oboe was around to stay. And as someone who has played the oboe, it is very challenging, but very rewarding. A great oboe player is really fabulous, and that instrument can just dance and sing and play like nothing else. So, my dear student who asked this question, I'm glad you noticed the oboe. I'm glad you were listening to Bach Cantata 140, and I'm glad you asked the question, because now we know that the oboe, which was the shawm, which was potentially the aulos and tibia from the ancient times, is what brought us double reeds today. And I'd like to just remind you that double reed players were total rock stars in the Greek and Roman times. And if you're a double reed player, or you know a double reed player, or you like double reeds, I think you're still a rock star today. Great question. Next!
One topic that I think would be interesting would be learning more about Mozart's Requiem. I think from what we learned in class, it's pretty interesting that he wrote the first half and then sketched out his notes for the rest. And so it had two people's work on it. And I think it'd be interesting to hear more and somebody else elaborate on the topic.
So Mozart's Requiem. You know, if you've seen Amadeus, which is not completely the truth, it does get you excited. I think the way that the film uses pieces of Mozart's work, and not Mozart's work, to really embody the film gets me excited about Mozart's music. But let's talk. Let's really talk about this idea of Mozart and his Requiem. So it was written in 1791, and it was originally commissioned by a stranger. Now, keep in mind that Mozart was one of those first entrepreneurial music types where he worked for patrons and wasn't so great at holding down a job. Think of the people that came before him, like Handel and Bach, who worked for people really well. Mozart wasn't so great about really keeping a boss. So he did a lot of commissions. And this was the same time he was working on the magic flute. There's lots of stories around the person who commissioned it. But the point is that in 1791, Mozart convinced the patron who asked for this Requiem commission to give him kind of a little bit of some money in the beginning, promising the rest of the money and the rest of the work later. Well, something happened. Mozart died in the middle of that. So there were only sketches of the Kyrie and the Requiem movements. The rest were finished by a few other people. Now, rumor has it, a few days before Mozart died, he actually had a big singing party, kind of like a bunch of us getting together and sight reading Barbershop or a cappella music or, you know, big hits of the 1780s in Mozart's grand room or something. But people had gotten together and sang through his sketches. Well, after he passed away, Mozart's wife had to get the work done. She needed the money. So first she asked another guy, Joseph von Eibler, to work on this piece. Well, he could only really do the orchestration of the Kyrie, and then he kind of gave up. He did recommend Franz Xaver Süssmange, a pupil of Mozart. And Süssmange, this is German, it's a S with an U, umlaut, and two S's and a mayor. Süssmange. He borrowed a bunch of Eibler's things, and he worked to complete the Requiem. First, he added his own orchestration to the Kyrie, still borrowing from some of the other things. Then he added his Lacrimosa, and then all the other required pieces, the Sanctus, the Benedictus, and the Agnus Dei. He concluded the work by a mashup, as in he borrowed ideas and adapted things from the two original movements made by Mozart. So the Lux Aeterna is actually like a a 17th century mashup thingy, bobber. So to make the final product look convincingly like it was in Mozart's hand, that he actually wrote the whole thing beginning to end, rewrote it before there was like, you know, copy paste, rewrote it by hand, forged Mozart's signature, put the 1792 date on it, and gave it to the patron who paid for it. So did Mozart write the Requiem? Did he give the ideas? Was this the first, like, collaboration, if we're thinking back to number two in our series? I don't know. But it sure is fascinating. And if you haven't listened to the whole work, you really need to, because you can hear the emotion in it. It really does sound like Mozart, but what does Mozart sound like? That's another question for another time. Next!
What determines the genre a piece of music is?
I love talking about genres. Now, genres are a big part of how I organize my introduction to music class. We don't just go in historical beginning to end of history for introduction to music. Instead, I organize it around all the genres. Music that is sacred, music that is secular, music on the stage, music with friends. That's how I structure. So you're actually going through history multiple times, which gives you an opportunity to hopefully get a better feel for the different periods classical music. But let's talk about genres. By definition, a genre is a style of music. As we heard in part two, episode 30, there were three genres that came together to create rock and roll. And then from there, just a splintering of genres through the grunge, through today. But why genres? Well, there's three really good reasons that you need to have genres. It's a descriptor. You need to be able to describe what the music is like. If someone said, "What's your favorite type of music?" You can typically describe what type of music that is, and then you know what genres usually fall into those categories. It also, genres helps you classify the audience, and that's really important for number three, marketing, decision-making, money-related stuff. So genre as a classification is important for description, for knowing the audience, and for ultimately making the money. Now, take a piece of paper, a pen, a note, write this down. Everynoise.com. I'll say it again. Everynoise.com. This website is my favorite rabbit hole. So Spotify data's alchemist Glenn McDonald took a ton of data, and he's the guy who helps them classify all of their genres, and I can't even tell you how many genres are on Spotify because it changes all of the time. But what this everynoise.com does is offer you three things in my mind. A wonderful rabbit hole to go down, a genre map, and unnamed genres. Hint, when you go to this website, on the top left, next to where it says Everynoise, there's a little tiny thing that says scan. Click that button and sit back and relax. You will be taken on an incredible musical journey. You might hear Lithuanian electronic, or happy hardcore, or old school boogie, or funk, spelled P-H-O-N-K. Don't take my word for it. Just go to everynoise.com. The point being that genres are the classification, the style of music, and we are so lucky, thanks to globalization, thanks to technology, that we get to be in the driver's seat and see this incredible splintering of genres. Now, the cool part about everynoise.com is if you know a genre that you like, you can click on that genre. Don't worry, there's a search button so you won't get lost in the big word maze. You can click on that genre and see a map of what's influenced it and what it has influenced. If we're thinking back to series number two, when we're talking about rock and roll, you know rock and roll came from mainstream pop, rhythm and blues, and country western. So if you follow those maps, you might find new genres that you like. This everynoise.com also gives you some great artists that align with those genres. So genres, it's just a descriptive word. So you know your audience and who you're talking to, and so that marketing folks can make money. But it's also just really fun. I dare you to go find at least three new genres. I think you might like that Lithuanian electronic or funk with a PH. Just saying. Let me know what you think.
I love country music, and I would like to know more about its musical origins. Please could you give me more info on this?
A perfect question to follow up our genre question. Country is one of those genres. And if you go to country on everynoise.com, you will see a bajillion splintering genres that come from it. But let's talk about where country came from. First, it was originally called country western, and it originated in the rural South and the West. It was originally very regionalized, and it wasn't shortened to just country until 1949. And this was done by the recording industry because, quote, hillbilly music was deemed offensive. So country western became country. Where did this genre come from? Well, just like we saw with rock and roll, that its roots were mainstream pop and country western and rhythm and blues, the roots of country western music lie in ballads, folk songs, and popular songs of the English, Scottish, and Irish settlers of the Appalachians and the South. P.S. If you haven't read America's Nations, it's a great nonfiction book about one researcher's thoughts on where our heritage comes from based on where we've settled and where we've lived. My family is Appalachian and Southern, and it's really interesting to see where those roots started from. I know that has nothing to do with music, but American Nations, it's a great nonfiction book. And as I was doing the research on this genre in particular, it really sparked my thoughts because so much of the music that influenced the country western genre came from the Appalachians in the South. And there's just a lot of really interesting traditions about migration and people patterns and movement patterns and thought patterns that I found interesting in that book, not related to music. Anyway, back to country. In the early 1920s, you started to see the traditional string band coming into existence, and they were actually made popular because of Fiddlin' John Carson, who recorded some songs and got the genre's first hit album or first hit record in 1923. Side note, do you know why things are called albums? Well, back in the day when records were made, so still like those flat discs that were originally made out of not vinyl, when records were made, they didn't hold much music, and so you had to have a lot of them to have the entire song. I think like there was a piece by Beethoven that was like 19 or 20 flat records front and back, and you had to change it every few minutes. So to keep those organized, people put their discs in these booklets that looked a lot like photo albums, and so rumor has it that's where the title album came from, because you would have all these flat records in this book that you would flip through. I have one that I actually use for show and tell when I'm teaching history of rock and roll, but you can find them. Just go Google it, the original albums. It's quite fascinating. Anyway, first hit record of the country western genre, thanks to Fiddlin' John Carson in 1923. Now, the growth of country music was due largely in part to three things: broadcast radio and two big performance spaces. The National Barn Dance in Chicago, which started in 1924, and the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville, which started in 1925. Thanks to a lot of migration and industry development after the Great Depression and World War II, country found its way into new places, and then it influenced and was influenced by other genres, such as blues and gospel. So that takes us to the 1930s. This is when we start to see a rise in cowboy films and the stars in cowboy films. And there's lots of commercialism that's bringing country music more to the mainstream audiences. This mainstream flow continues through the 1970s, where we start to see outlaw country coming into being. And at this time, there starts to be a narrowing of the gap between country music and mainstream pop. And this is largely in part because of instrumental changes. So the original country western had that fiddling kind of acoustic band. Well, by the 70s, we start seeing things like the electric guitar get added into country music. This all leads to more and more acceptance for a more nationwide urban audience, not just the original Appalachian South or West or regional audiences that it was originally intended to, or the Nashville audiences or the Chicago audiences where those two performance halls were. Instead, there are, and we see this in lots of genres, there are more connections or integrations of mainstream culture into the genre to make it more well known. So two of the people specifically asked by this student in the question, I didn't keep the whole question in there, but the student specifically asked about Dolly and Reba. And they were really big parts of the diverse 20th century performers that really, really narrowed the gap. In fact, today, if you look at the top songs, you'll see all different genres. It's not just popular music. There are country songs on the top charts. And there's lots of other things too, like rap and hip hop and rock. Anyway, Dolly pioneered the interface between country and pop culture. So if you go back and look at some of the original Dolly stuff, you see how she's really crossing over into that pop world. Reba was also a crossover, but she crossed over between country music and being a TV star. Now, if you seriously like country music, even if you don't seriously like country music, you have to go check out the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville. It is one of the coolest places I've ever taken a group of singers to, and I really learned a ton. I love to see how genres influence and impact other genres. And I think there's always something you can learn about another culture, another lived experience, if you just listen to the music of other people. Even if you don't love it, there's always something to take out of it. So lots of cool things about country western, which then became country. I hope this helps get you started down the path. Go to Nashville. Check out that Country Music Hall of Fame.
I am really big into kind of the gospel, like country music. So I've always kind of wondered where that came from. But like two of my biggest idols were Reba McEntire and Dolly Parton.
There's that Reba and Dolly reference. I knew I'd heard it somewhere. Well, I've already answered that part of the question. Let's talk about gospel music. I love these genre questions. So the definition of gospel music, it is a genre of American Protestant music rooted in the religious revivals of the 19th century, which developed in different directions within the European American and African American communities. So it's a lot like country. It was influenced and spread through publishing and concerts and recording and radio and TV broadcast and religious services. And oh, y'all, I have a cousin who was on Broadway and now is an actor on TV shows. And if you haven't seen Filthy Rich on Fox, he's one of the characters. His name is Corey Cott. He might kill me for doing this, but you need to go watch Filthy Rich. There are some great gospel songs in there that show how TV evangelists and different types of radio and recordings and TV broadcasts really spread music to a lot of different audiences. Anyway, Filthy Rich, Fox. Totally off topic, but kind of not, because gospel music, like so many other genres, was greatly influenced by media. So in the 20th century, gospel music developed into a popular commercial genre. These artists at this time started touring worldwide. Let me be honest, I owned every Kurt Franklin CD from the 1990s and early 2000s. I literally could sing it word for word right now if you played it. I tested it out on Apple Music before I recorded this episode. We can play that game another time. Anyway, all the dates go back to what was the purpose of the music in the worship service. So if you're looking at gospel music, look at the roots, trace the roots back to where was it used in the service? What was its purpose in the service? What was the style of the worship service? Was there a liturgy? Was it inside a church building? Was it outside at a revival service? Just like country, this genre of gospel music was really influenced by folk and ragtime and blues and jazz. So there are also historical genres you'll start to see in there, like hymnody and spirituals. There are some really great books on this. I highly recommend. I read both of these, and there are so many things. We could do episodes just on these. But People Get Ready is by Robert Darden, D-A-R-D-E-N, and Way Over in Beulah Land by Dr. Andre Thomas. If you have not read that one is exceptional. I just got People Get Ready when I was doing this research, but I have owned Way Over in Beulah Land for a while. And if you are interested in gospel music, that is a fabulous resource. But as you can see, both country and gospel, and all genres for that matter, started in one place for a purpose, for a people, for someone to articulate or entertain or have a place to share emotions. And as our world has progressed and technologies have advanced and media has integrated into our society, you see these genres start impacting each other. And I think that's the coolest part of all of this. Yeah, genre is a descriptive purpose. But each one of those genres tells a story about a lived experience, and there's so much to learn by all the different genres out there. So be proud. Whatever you love, love on that genre. And don't close your mind or ears to any other genres. Always be open to explore new sounds and new things. It doesn't have to be your total fave. I'm sorry, I'm never gonna love screamer rock. But there is a time and a place for it, so I will always appreciate that it exists. Okay, that is it for that question. Whew, there you have it. The third series of my introduction to music questions from students at the university level. I think I'm all winded having to talk to myself. Please let me know what you think of these Doctor Is In episodes, how you're enjoying the podcast. We're wrapping up 2020 here shortly, and I'd love to know what you think. Am I meeting your needs? Is there anything else that you need? Do you like the repertoire exploration episodes? Do you like the Doctor Is In episodes? Do you want more interviews? Do you want more teaching tips? What can I do to give you the tools and resources you need for a fantastic 2021 and beyond? If you want to join the conversation and actually get some of your questions into these Doctor Is In episodes, jump over to patreon.com/musicedmatters. We'd love to have conversations with you. We have monthly meetup chats on Zoom and lots of different conversations all month long. And then, of course, the annual Music Ed Matters Teacher PD Week, which I'm super stoked about already, and it's not even 2021. Thank you so much for listening. Please know that whatever you are doing right now, it matters. Obviously, by today's discussion and every other discussion, we know that music matters. And I will see you next time on the Music Ed Matters podcast.